Welcome to Tribecast. I am Forrest Walden, founder and CEO of Iron Tribe Fitness. And on this podcast, I am going to help you find your tribe and maximize your life. Welcome to another episode of Tribecast. Today's guest, Jason Williams, the founder and executive director of Aspire, a ministry that's near and dear to my heart and many people I know that are involved in it, after the hearts and lives of at-risk youth. Jason will get all into that as we proceed with this conversation. But Jason, welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me, Forrest.
Jason is a competitive triathlete. No doubt he has already spent 2 hours on the bike this morning. Married 16 years to his better half, 3 kids, and really excited to unpack his life lessons, what he does to stay at the top of his game, starting and leading a startup ministry. That is not easy, as we know. So, Jason, just let the listeners know who you are for those who are not familiar with you.
Jason Williams, the executive director of the Aspire Movement, and I consider myself, and you are probably too, from the greatest generation, right? The Xennial generation, where we grew up going outside and making up our own games and had to come in when the streetlights came on. But we also evolved with the first pager, with the first BlackBerry, with the first car phone, and now obviously with smartphones and computers. So I feel like that's part of my story too, just kind of being from a bridge generation, that's part of the calling that's on my life is being a bridge in between people groups.
And you did not grow up in Birmingham, which is obviously part of your story as well. Talk about that.
Yeah. So I was born in Frederick, Maryland, which is about 30 miles north of Washington, D.C. But I moved around a lot. I lived in 9 different places the first 10 years of my life. Part of that was my dad was a new Christian and felt called into ministry. And unfortunately, we just picked up and moved at a whim. And some of those places, like my mom was even reminding me a couple weeks ago, we literally lived in like a trailer, 5 of us, me and my 2 older siblings.
Wow.
For about 3 months. So you talk about being cramped and just growing up really mobile, basically, not having a stability and somewhere to kind of call home.
Okay. And I know from hearing your story in the past and you speaking to my team, you didn't have maybe the most idyllic and easy childhood. So talk about that and really how that has shaped your whole direction with both professional and ministry.
Sure. I like to tell my story in 3 parts, you know, hypocrisy, hedonism, and hope. And so hypocrisy was really the form of Christianity that I was exposed to until I was about, you know, 11, 12 years old. And then I became completely alienated from the church and the people of God. But people were marked out during that time, not for grace and mercy and love and kindness and compassion, but things like racism and hypocrisy. And my dad was the biggest image of Christianity in my life. He was a man who woke up early, who prayed, who read his Bible, who put his kids into Christian school at a very early age. But there were just these huge discrepancies in his life, emotional, verbal, physical abuse to my mom, and then some issues later on with my oldest sister. And so for me, I became very disenfranchised with people who called themselves Christians. Obviously, because he was the role model that I had to look up to.
Sure.
And so I did what every kid does. You know, you search for your identity, you search for purpose, and you search for meaning in life. What does this all really mean in the end? And I answered that by way of hedonism. And so for me, life was about power and pleasures and possessions. And it's like popularity. I think we're all hardwired where we want to be accepted and we want to be affirmed. And we don't realize that that's actually a good thing, but the way in which we go about getting that is sometimes the struggle. And so for me, you know, I was a you know, white kid growing up in a predominantly black neighborhood. And so I had 2 avenues that I was going to make a name for myself. And that was dribbling and shooting a basketball and selling illegal narcotics. And like, I did both of those things very well. And they kind of were two lives that I lived that ran parallel until that all crashed and came to a head. When I was 19 years old, I was arrested and charged with felony drug trafficking. I lost a Division I basketball scholarship.
Yeah, I was gonna say, at that point, you're playing college basketball, right?
Yeah, so I went to DeMatha High School, which is renowned for basketball. Mm-hmm. Played for Morgan Wooten, actually lived at his house for a couple semesters as well. And so I signed with George Mason out of high school because, you know, to me it was 15 minutes away from home. I could keep living my life. My mom could come watch me play. You know, by this time my parents had divorced. And so it was just a really good fit. Plus, you know, I'm a Magic Johnson fan growing up, you know, an 80s baby. And like, the head coach at that time, when I went on the recruitment visit, he had a picture with him with his arm around Magic, and he was wearing an NBA championship ring from 1980, and he was promising me 25 shots a game as a freshman. So I'm like, hey, man, where do I sign? I'm in. And so I did, man, a very successful freshman year, averaged 17 points a game, was all-conference player many weeks out of the year, but at the same time, never went to class, had a .8 GPA.
Wow.
And it was at that time that my coaches were like, you got to go to summer school, man, or you're going to be academically ineligible. And I didn't, man.
And you're dealing drugs at the same time, right? You're living this kind of double life.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I didn't, you know, want to go to college. And I had a problem with authority at that time. Anybody who was telling me what to do, I was basically like, scram, man. You know, I'm making $5,000 to $10,000 a week. And but that life caught up with me June 11, 1996. You know, I remember very vividly being arrested and felt like life was coming to an end. And so when I lost my scholarship, I ended up getting arrested five more times that year. It was really like one of the darkest points in my life. Even tried to take my life. Alcohol, basically spent the night drinking two-fifths of Hennessy and ended up in somebody's backyard, passed out. And if they didn't find me and send me to the hospital where I had my stomach pumped, the doctors were like, you probably would have died. So just came to the end of myself and realized that everything that I was striving for to give me an identity, to give me purpose, was actually creating more and more consequences, life-ending consequences. And so, yeah, that kind of came to a head. And thankfully, I was given another opportunity after a year of not going to school. I was given an opportunity in Florida to play at a junior college. And from there, ended up transferring to Birmingham Southern, which is how I ended up in Birmingham. It's so ironic because I found out 2 days before school started that I was coming to Birmingham. And it was not like, you know, this was on my recruitment visit and, you know, this is where I set out to come. It really was a last chance opportunity for me to finish college. And that's when I got introduced to hope, and that was meeting my wife, who we've been together now for 20 years, been married 16. But
let me stop you. I'm curious, what was your expectation or even thoughts of Birmingham, Alabama, coming from Washington, D.C., and where you grew up? What did you think you were coming to?
Yeah, so the only thing that I knew about Birmingham was the fire hoses and Martin Luther King in the 60s, you know, civil rights. That was really the only exposure that I had. I also knew it was really hot here, which has stayed true ever since the day I stepped foot on
yes, it has,
this place.
Including today in October, still 100
that's
degrees.
That's right, man. But yeah, those were kind of my expectations. And I'll be honest, I was a little worried. You know, I'm a white kid who's always had black girlfriends and, you know, lived in this predominantly black environment. And so, you know, then couple that with coming to Birmingham Southern, which somebody had told me, like, this is a really wealthy school. And so I'll never forget, man, the first day I stepped foot on campus, August 28th, 1998. And here I am with Timberland boots on, you know, shorts that look like capris, you know, down past my knees. I got herringbone gold chain. I got a hat. I got on these big headphones, kind of like the ones you're wearing. And like, I'm looking around and like, people are looking at me like I'm an alien, man. Like, who is this kid?
Wow. Okay, so you got a shot to play basketball again.
I did.
And you played there how many years?
So I played there 2 years.
Okay.
I finished out my junior and senior year, and it's really like, by the grace of God, I didn't get kicked off the team. I mean, there were so many times. Just again, you know, here I am now trying to change my life, but realizing I've got all these pent up anger issues. I've got all this, these challenges with authority that, you know, looking back, I realized kind of stemmed from my dad and things like that. But thankfully, man, my coach, Coach Dwayne Riebel, he hung in there with me. He kept giving me more chances. And really was the first time I realized that, that in order, you know, to really show somebody love, discipline comes alongside of that as well.
All right, so at this point, have you left your drug lifestyle behind and you see this as a chance to start over, although you're still struggling with authority and all that? I'm assuming that part's done once you came to Birmingham?
Yeah, so, no, man, it's funny. The first person that I became friends with was a guy who worked in the cafeteria, and that was because I smelled marijuana on him. Mm. And so, like, literally, like, even coming to Birmingham, I continued in my drug habits for another 5 years.
Okay.
What was interesting was, you know, really the turning point in my life was in 2000 when I graduated. And then I went from playing basketball, people asking me for my autograph, kind of being a hero, to like getting up at 4 a.m. and going to work and being a nobody. And that was so hard for me
that I remember that transition.
Turned to drugs and alcohol even more. Yeah. So much so that I almost, you know, by this time I was engaged, I almost lost my fiance because she was just kind of fed up. She was like, I thought things would continue to get better.
And, so, and that's your wife now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, correct. And so what was interesting was I surrendered my life to Jesus in 2000, and it was authentic, man. I cried for about 4 or 5 hours and just pleaded for God to have mercy on my soul. I didn't need anybody to explain to me I was a sinner. I knew who I was. I just couldn't believe that Jesus came and died in my place, that he kind of substituted my terrible life for his perfect life. And then gave me his righteousness. But in that process, you know, things don't change overnight. I mean, yes, there were certain things like my speech immediately changed, my passions, but I still continued to wrestle with drugs and alcohol for another 3 years, so much to the point that, you know, my wife will tell you, like, I would go get high and literally cry afterwards and just be angry at myself. Like, why am I doing this? Like, I can't be a Christian if I'm doing this stuff. And so it was really hard for me because here I am knowing there's these changes taking place in my life, but at the same time living the contradiction that I knew I hated growing up, and like kind of realizing like, wow, there may be a little bit of hypocrisy in all of us here. Mm-hmm. And it was great because I've asked God recently, like, why did it take so long for me to kind of get rid of those things? And It's about pride and humility. Mm-hmm. And he's like, Jason, if I just zapped you and took away all your problems and all your sins, like, how humble do you think you would be?
Yeah.
You know, how much would you really understand what I've accomplished for you? And how much would you rely and depend on me day to day? Mm-hmm. So that was a huge part of kind of my initial, you know, introduction to Christianity and then call into ministry as well.
Okay, so let's unpack a little bit more. You said hypocrisy, hedonism, and hope. And I kind of cut you off. The hope part started by meeting your wife.
Correct.
And then eventually that led to conversion.
Yes.
I'm interested, because you grew up in the church, would you have said you were a Christian before that point, or you knew you were lost and the gospel like just totally surrendered you?
You know, it's interesting. I feel like I know I was lost. You know, my mom would say, Jason, at 5, 6 years old, you were sharing your faith. You were such a good kid. There was so much fruit in your life. You loved Jesus. So I don't really know. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing is I don't know the exact point of conversion. If I was backslidden, it was a long time, you know, 12 years or so of living that life. So I really don't know the answer to that. But I do know that if you would have looked at my life during the time I was a teenager, you would have seen no visible fruit whatsoever.
Yep.
That my life was predicated on serving and glorifying God.
So with hypocrisy and legalism and religion, you didn't find hope. You didn't find identity. With hedonism, clearly you didn't find it. You know, it's so interesting, in my Bible study this morning, we were talking about this. We're in Romans. We were talking about this very topic, and I had just watched the movie Rocket Man with Elton John. There's some pretty risque scenes in there, but the whole story is him pursuing identity and success. His parents basically gave him no love, no respect, and he just went full after. And he had everything the world says you'd want: fame, fortune, and, you know, basically drove himself almost to the point of death with drugs. So it's just that same story, that there is no satisfaction in the things of this world. So in Hope, you found that through Christ, and I think where we left off is that's really set the direction for your life. So just talk about how you go from there to founding Aspire and where you are now.
Yeah, so as soon as I surrendered my life to the Lord, I immediately had a call to the marginalized people groups in the world, right? So kids who were growing up fatherless in similar situations that I found myself in, guys who were in prison, guys who were getting out of prison, jail, trying to reenter back into society, the homeless population, the orphan and the widow, basically. And for me, I didn't even really realize and know that there was a call from God throughout the scriptures to that group. It was almost instinctive in me that I'm going to go back to the people who I know, people who that I know are struggling and have similar stories to myself. And so that's what I did. I had no strategy. I had no ministry. I was working as a salesman at a car dealership, but I would spend my free time volunteering at homeless ministries. I would go and preach there. I would go into prisons around Alabama and did a discipleship group for 2 years, and just found myself constantly in these environments where my story was really resonating with people. And I felt like the hope that I was, that was given to me, I was now passing on to them. And so in that process, you know, I began to really kind of narrow my focus. And I think this happens with us, right? Like our purpose begins to kind of get funneled down as you gain experience, as you realize what you're good at, what you're not good at. Ended up going into full-time ministry, becoming the local missions pastor, the urban ministry pastor at Briarwood Presbyterian Church for 6 years. And it was kind of during that time that my focus really shifted to prevention and youth in particular. I wasn't seeing a whole lot of fruit coming from prison ministry, reentry, homeless. Not that people aren't called to that, but for me, the kids that I spent time with, these 9, 10, 11-year-olds, man, they were going to college, they were getting married. You were just seeing their life really impacted just because an adult came into their life and said, you have worth, you have dignity. God's called you to a purpose greater than yourself. And so kind of seeing that, and then also realizing there's this enormous fatherless problem here in the city we live in, Birmingham. 38,000 kids are growing up in single parent homes.
Wow.
Growing up in a single parent home, you're 4 times more likely to end up in poverty. You're more likely to end up on drugs, you're more likely to end up dropping out of high school, you're more likely to get pregnant. I mean, there's so many things you're at risk of, right, because of the environment that you're living in. But then working in the church, I began to see, and then knowing my background, that there's another group that's at risk, and that's us, like church members, right, risk.
Well, I was going to point out, like, I grew up at Briarwood, so you're in a very conservative Presbyterian church, what, 90, I'm guessing 97% white. I mean, and here you are with this call to the marginalized, probably ruffled some feathers even there. So just an interesting place that God landed you with that call on your life. Not that Broward doesn't care about those people, but as a large population, that's not who that congregation looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. And what was really interesting about that experience was, you know, God really showed me something about my own heart that was wicked in that process, because I had no problem loving marginalized people. Where my issue was I hated wealthy people.
Mm.
And I felt like all wealthy people were not, there's no way you can serve God, right, and have money. Like, those things just don't mix.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to be delivered of that. And some of my greatest friends now have been forged through that process of God really revealing, like, listen, I'm not a respecter of person, man, whether poor or rich or white or black or male or female. Like, I set my love on who I set my love on.
Mm.
And you will too. And so that was a great experience for me. Also, you know, I'm very much, I'm fly by the seat of my pants, right? I'm risk. I am an INTJ and, like, very much visionary and let's go and let's do it. being at Briarwood really helped put structure in my life. It helped me think strategically that right now those experiences are pretty much shaping what I do on a day-to-day basis. Everything from leadership, organization, policy, procedures, like I really needed that experience in order to do what I'm doing now, which I didn't see it at the time. You know, at the time I'm like, man, you got these shackles on
you're
me, bro.
You're putting me in a box.
Yeah, it's like, don't you know, like we need to take this risk for the kingdom. And it's funny, you look back and you see like, man, God's plan is so amazing. You know, I joke with people often, my social security number starts with 205, and growing up in D.C., Birmingham, Alabama wasn't on my radar, and yet he's the one who determined, I will set you in the 205. That's where you will start, you know, your new life and ministry. So it's really been God's grace that kind of going through all those situations has shaped the person that I am today.
All right, so talk to us about Aspire, how you founded it, where it is today, and what it does, because it's an awesome ministry.
Yeah, so the Aspire movement has a vision of transforming youth to reflect Christ and restore their community. And we do that through our mission, which is equipping mentors to develop and deploy the next generation of leaders through mutually transforming relationships. So I hate to call us a mentoring program because we're the furthest thing from a program. We are literally a movement. We're a movement of God's people who are aspiring to leave a legacy. We're a movement of at-risk youth who are aspiring to change the forecast of their future, to hopefully become, you know, statesmen, elders and deacons, business owners, you name it. And so we started in 2011. It was really an idea. And we said, okay, let's start with fourth graders because I've done a lot of background study and 9-year-olds seems to be a really good age, right? 9-year-olds are starting to develop an adult mind and they can have conversations, but they still have a children's heart. We learned that when you start with 14, 15-year-olds, they're already a little callous. They're not as open and transparent as a 9-year-old. And so in 2011 at Restoration Academy, we matched 13 mentors with 13 kids, life on life, with the hope that those mentors would stay engaged in the life of the child until they graduated high school, and then in turn, they would have lifelong friendships, right? And so I'm excited to say that this year, 9 of those kids are still in our program, and wow, 9 of those kids are scheduled to graduate senior high school this year, which is just a testament, because at that point we didn't even have any structure when we started. We didn't have any support. These are just people that were called by God that kind of endured through a lot of mess and the forming of our organization. So
this is the first group that you've been able to see all the way from 9 to graduation.
Yes.
You're really starting to see the harvest now.
Yes.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, and one in particular, I won't share his name, but, you know, he's a young man that if you looked at him at 9 years old, statistically, you would say there's no way he's going to make it. He lived in the poorest zip code in Birmingham. His mother and father had both abandoned him. His mother was actually arrested with a kilo of cocaine her senior year of high school.
Wow.
And then had him in jail. So, he grew up with various family members. He was expelled or suspended every year up until fourth grade. And then I met this kid, but he had the most dynamic personality. And you just knew, like, man, this kid's a leader and this kid is smart. And so the next year, you know, by fifth grade, now all of a sudden he's teacher's assistant. And now he's a senior. He's in the band. He's in the robotics club. He's got a 4.2 GPA in honors classes. I'm working with a couple local congressmen to help get him recommendations because he wants to go to West Point.
Wow.
And ultimately be some kind of engineer with NASA. And it's just an amazing story. But the thing that he says that's more important than all of that stuff I just shared is, Jason, when I grow up, I'm going to be a mentor. You know, I want to give to a kid what you gave to me, which is hope, which is possibility, which is opportunity. And so that in a microcosm, hopefully, is what we'll see. Obviously, every story is not a success like that. But that one right now is huge.
And I want to point out, just in case the listeners missed it, what you did for that kid is you talked about 2 at-risk populations here. Here's a kid. It's so easy to see that he's at risk. But you're point is, and I think one that would be easily missed, is the other at-risk group is us comfortable over the mountain, affluent, predominantly white leaders and business owners and executives who are missing out on being able to give their life to the marginalized. So what you did is you took someone from that population, you matched it with this kid, and he met with them, I'm assuming, every week or whatever your program is, and it changed the kid's life.
Yeah.
He had a male role model.
And that's kind of the core principle of what we do. Our philosophy is that these are mutually transforming relationships. This is not simply the mentor who's entering in, who has the wisdom and the background and the network, but he's entering in humility, also desiring to be a learner. And it's not just some transaction, but it's actually relationship and exchange. And through that, we've seen that the mentors and the students get transformed really in similar ways. And we define those in three ways: prevention, perspective, and purpose. Mm. And so, you know, from a prevention standpoint, we know what the at-risk kid is preventing from. But for the person who is affluent, who's living in a materialistic society that's constantly telling them what they need to make them happy, you know, engaging with a youth that is from an under-resourced neighborhood prevents them from a lot of things, right? I'll never forget, I had a young man over at my house, and I was doing laundry, and he walks in, and he's like, "You got a washer and dryer in your house? You know, do you have to put money in it?" And I'm like, "No, man." And he's overwhelmed by that. And it really rocked me, because I'm thinking, how much do I really appreciate the fact that on a Saturday I can just throw clothes in the washer and dryer, go back to watching football or whatever I'm doing, and I don't have to worry about somebody stealing it. And he's telling me stories about how he has to get together quarters. He has to, you know, get transportation to go to wash his clothes, and he has to sit there and wait by him for 4 hours. And just the things that we take for granted in life, right? I think being with a kid who's growing up in difficult situation kind of keeps us from going off the rails and being really discontent, right, about things that are happening in our life. I mean, I know for one, I miss so many things that God does in my life that I don't appreciate, or I just don't reflect enough with thanksgiving. And so being in these relationships kind of draws you back into the things that are the most important. So there's prevention on both sides, but there's also perspective. And, you know, I joke around. I had a couple kids in my car, and we were riding through Mountain Brook to go to this event. And it's funny because, you know, people from over the mountain are always like, "Man, you drive into Fairfield and Woodlawn, and like, isn't that dangerous?" And I'm sitting here with these two kids in my car, two African-Americans, and they're scared to death we're riding through Mountain Brook, man. They're just like the fear of God. And I'm like, what's wrong? What's up? And they're like, "Man, we can't ride through here. You know, we're black and white together in the car, and this is Mountain Brook." And so again, like, we have all these stereotypes that oftentimes go unchallenged. Mm-hmm. And so our perspective changes. You know, for a kid who's coming out of the inner city, they usually, when you say, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" "Well, I'm going to be in the NFL. I'm going to be in the NBA. I'm going to be an entertainer." You know, it reminds me of the movie Rocky. They ask Rocky, "Why do you fight?" And he's like, "Because I can't sing or dance." You know, I mean, when you grow up poor, he was from the Italian hood in Philly. When you grow up poor, you got these limited options. So your perspective of life is this 4-block radius. And you're like, that's the only way I can make it in life. And so you get with a mentor, somebody who's a CPA or somebody who, you know, runs a fitness ministry or anything along those lines. And now all of a sudden the kid has new aspirations, right? His world just became enlarged at the possibilities of jobs that are out there for him. But then also for the mentors, like, their perspective gets changed as well. I've had some people confide in me that when they entered the program, you know, they felt like people were poor just simply because they were lazy, right? If you would just work harder, if you would apply yourself, you would be the next Ben Carson. Mm-hmm. And what you realize when you're engaged in these situations is it's not only individual responsibility for the young person to work hard, to develop character, to make wise decisions, but at the same time, he's sometimes trapped in a system that's failing him. Whether it be failing schools where the teacher is literally calling him stupid every day, where it is an environment where he's not getting nutritional food to come home to, where he's having to come home and basically maybe even be a parent to his younger kids and spend time babysitting. And we're wondering why this kid's not doing his homework and why he's not showing up fresh at school. And so your perspective changes and you realize that these issues are a lot more complex than we want to give them credit for. It's not as simple to solve as just, well, provide more or just do this one thing. It's very complex.
In fact, that can make it worse.
Yeah, it brings you into a place of real dependency, I think, and trust. And so, and then ultimately the last thing is purpose. And we feel like it gives purpose and a legacy to the mentor. You know, so many of us, and I myself included, like, man, I want to be a great father. I want to be a great husband. You know, I want my kids to succeed. I want to provide every opportunity possible. But you know what? If I die and that's what I've done, that was my responsibility. That's what I'm supposed to do. But what have I done sacrificially for the kingdom that's going to reverberate far beyond just my family? You know, I want to leave a legacy of young people who literally, like, the only reason that I'm involved in their life is simply because I love them. I want to leave that kind of legacy. And so I think it's an opportunity through Aspire to do those things, to, you know, gain purpose, to have your perspective enlarged, and then also to just prevent us from running off the rails.
Mm. You know what I love about that is I always say I need the perspective of a mission trip once a year to reset my parameter, to break me out of my bubble. I even said it this morning because we were talking about our groups taking a trip to Nepal in February. And I'm like, I need that. But what you're talking about, you literally get that every week.
You can do it every week.
Yeah. I'm like, seriously, having an epiphany right now of like, well, it doesn't take once a year. And as important as that is,
sure,
and it's as instrumental as that has been in my life, but you're really talking about getting that on a weekly basis in a life-on-life relationship. So that it's incredible. So you talked about 13 students in 2011. Where are you today?
So today we're at 245 students.
Okay.
It is phenomenal. I transitioned April of 2015. Since then, God has been so kind to us, and we've developed a team. We have 4 full-time staff and 2 part-time interns. And in addition to the life-on-life mentoring, growing to 245 mentor-student matches, we launched small group mentoring 3 years ago. So we also have about 100 kids and about 35 mentors doing that. And that's more of a short-term commitment, but it's a way for us to incorporate college students. Like, we've partnered with Stanford University, and so we have 5 of their students coming over every Wednesday and spending time with kids at a local public elementary school and using character development curriculum that we've been able to kind of write ourselves.
Very awesome. All right. So you have essentially a entrepreneur in the ministry world. I mean, you created something that didn't exist. You had a vision. You've built a team. You've clearly expanded it dramatically. God's blessing it. But I know that doesn't come at a cost from a leadership front. You and I briefly discussed it before we turned on the mic of just, you know, being the front man, being the leader. It comes with a lot of, you know, attacks. It comes with anxiety. It comes with stress. It comes with these big decisions. So let's talk about what you do to equip yourself as a leader. And let's start with Body.
Yeah.
And I know you've got a story there. So talk about what you do and what it's evolved into, because you're one of the most committed fitness guys I know now.
Yeah. Well, I'm grateful to Iron Tribe Fitness for that, because you guys launched me 6 years ago. You know, I was 325 pounds. By the way, I'm 6'7", so I didn't look fat, but I look like a lineman from, you know, University of Alabama or Auburn. I mean, but really became aware at a doctor's visit that my cholesterol was high, my blood pressure was high, and historically that doesn't run in my family. I had really just kind of forgotten about the physical body. And so I made a decision to, hey, I need to start walking. I need to start eating better. That transitioned into attending Iron Tribe and learning how to eat and eat for fuel, not just because I like the taste of the food so much. And in that process, I had a friend invite me to do a triathlon. Now, I'm a kid from D.C. who didn't know how to swim. The last time I rode a bike, it was a BMX with pegs on it. And, like, running, like, once basketball was over, I was like, I'll never run run again in my life unless it's like running for my life. So anyway, man, I got coaxed into doing this triathlon. It was a little sprint triathlon down at the beach, and I immediately got bit with this cycling bug, and I literally fell in love with the bike. There's something about seeing things differently, a little bit slower, being able to take in more of the outside environment where you're not going as slow as running, you're able to cover a lot more ground. And so, like, man, I launched into this unbelievable cycling campaign where now in the last 6 years, I've ridden 75,000 miles.
Wow.
So I bike about 15,000 miles a year. My regimen every day is I get up between 3:45 and 4 o'clock. I spend an hour with the Lord in prayer, in devotion, and then I hit the street by 5 a.m. and I usually ride for 2 to 3 hours every day.
And you have to get up that early if you're putting in that type of time on the pavement, right?
You do. And I think what a lot of people say is, well, how do you get up that early and then go to work? I would be tired. What I've learned is that if I don't get up early and do those things for my body, I'm exhausted. I'm actually more tired when I don't work out.
Yep.
Something about working out brings energy and clarity and focus. And I mean, let's face it, when I get home at 7:30 to kiss my daughter off to school, you know, and I've already put in 2.5-3 hours of activity and sweated and got my heart rate revved up, man, I feel great. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm feeling like, let's go kill the day. Mm-hmm. So it's been huge for me. And I've noticed that, you know, we're not just these spirit beings that walk around that you need to just fill your body up with the word and pray. Like, no, you better take care of your physical body.
That's right.
Your spirit is housed in that physical body. And by the way, if you're stressed, if you're tired, like, all those things impact your spiritual life. They impact your relationships. And so this whole thing is just woven together in such a way that you have to take care of your body.
So 320, 6 years ago, what are you now?
So I'm 200.
Okay, yeah, 6'7", 200, that's lean.
I was 41% body fat, now I'm about 15%. I've gotten as low as 10%, but I learned that I do better with a little bit more fat, especially on long 5-hour rides.
So are you training for anything competitively? Are you actually doing races and something you're like gearing towards right now?
So the season ended this past Sunday. I did a ride called Six Gap, which is in North Georgia. So it's 104 miles and close to 12,000 feet of elevation where you're just constantly going uphill or downhill. But this past year, I did win the Alabama State Road Race Championship.
Saw that.
For my age group. So I don't really set out each year to like, oh, here's my racing schedule and I'm going to do all these events, because that's kind of where I've had to find balance, because mm-hmm. I know in and of myself I would race every weekend. Thankfully, my wife is very in tune and like, hey, look, pick three events this year and that's the three yep. events that you roll in. And so I've been really, you know, conscientious about making sure that cycling doesn't become this huge idol, which, by the way, it has in some seasons of my life, and I've been able to overcome it, but it's always there to try to resurface. And so try to keep balance and not participate in too many events throughout the course of the year. And plus, I enjoy the process of training more than the event. Mm-hmm. The events actually stress me out. So I enjoy just waking up, and I do have an agenda, but at the same time, it's like, man, this is so much fun.
Are these rides solo, or do you have a group that you're riding?
So a little bit of both.
Okay.
You know, typically for me, I'll do 30 minutes to an hour before I meet up with a group, and then ride an hour or two with that group, and then I may do another 30 minutes to an hour solo. So it really just depends. And most times on the weekends, on Saturdays, we ride with a little bit larger group.
Yeah. All right. Well, you just brought up balance and your wife here in this last segment. So let's switch over and let's talk about Jessica, your three kids, how investing in those relationships, again, allows you to be more effective when you do show up at work in power. Talk about that.
Yeah. So my oldest is 23. My son, my daughter is 22, so they live in the D.C. area.
Okay.
Only get to see them once or twice a year now. But with my 10-year-old, one of the things we do is every Wednesday we have a date. And we've been doing that for 6 years. And so yesterday it was taking her to the mall, and getting some Cindy cinnamon sticks and a phone case. And, you know, sometimes it's just hanging out in the park, or it's going to play soccer with her. She loves to play soccer, so I like to train and practice with her. But really be intentional about investing time with her. You know, I've heard people say, oh, it's about quality, not quantity. Well, when it comes to kids, it's both, man. And you better be there, and you better be there often. Mm-hmm. So I've really prioritized family. You know, not only my daughter, but having dates with my wife as well. And since she's full time, I'm full time, we both have crazy schedules. For us, it may not flesh out in, like, you know, date nights every week, but it's like, hey, we got to put lunch on the calendar. So just really being intentional with them. Also, I'm a big believer in the church. I'm a big believer in gathered worship. And Sundays are like, man, this is for family to go to church and then for family to be together the rest of the day and to really just enjoy each other's company, to review the things that we talked about Sunday and worship, and to take a true Sabbath. So I'm very, you know, I'm really against a lot of the Sunday activities and sporting events that they're trying to get kids in. I've often told her, like, if it's involved Sunday games, like, we're out. We're just not going to do that, because we have to make our primary commitment. And it's not out of legalism, right? That, oh, we have to be at church. No, it's like we desire to be there because we know that that is the replenishment cycle. That is the fuel that we need to go another week and to go another week, you know, really hard.
So I'm assuming you don't train personally on Sunday.
So Sunday mornings for me is always a recovery ride. It's really easy, and it's usually close to the house, but it's done early enough that, you know, Sundays you don't want to miss out because nobody's on the road. So it's like, that's the best day to actually ride a bike in Birmingham because most people are still in bed.
So tell me about your marriage. You've mentioned her many times.
Yeah.
Sounds like she was instrumental in you and your conversion, and sounds like she's a great helpmate. So what do you do to keep that relationship strong?
Yeah, I think one of the greatest gifts that God has given us is a similar passion. So, you know, the majority of her work and research centers around the area of explicit and implicit bias and between races. And so, I mean, we just have these long, drawn-out conversations about things that we're both really passionate about. And so that's been one of the primary ways, obviously, is that we connect on a regular basis, is just kind of through similar passion. But also just spending time together. Again, I've mentioned this before, it's not just quality time, it's quantity time. So I'm really excited. My daughter, my 10-year-old, is going away on her first kind of overnight trip retreat. I've got something special planned for my wife. I'm not going to say it just in case she listens to this, but it will be a surprise. So I think the main thing is just being very intentional.
And I actually have a connection with your wife because I cheered with her sister at Auburn.
Yeah.
So it was interesting when I put those two and two together. But I have a multiracial family because I adopt. Jessica's black. You have a multiracial family and a multiracial daughter, right?
Yeah.
Talk about, and that really plays into what you do every day with your role. Talk about that in Birmingham, Alabama, you know, with our history, like how that impacts how you guys live out, or does it even impact how you guys live out your calling?
You know, I think it's really interesting. I think every individual situation is different. And my wife and I have never been the hypersensitive type. You know, oh, they're staring at us. Oh, can you believe they're looking at us? They're smirking. We really don't care. I hate to say it that way.
Yep.
But we have not received anything blatant, visible in our life, nor has our daughter. Our daughter has grown up really appreciating and loving her white side of the family, appreciating and loving her black side of the family. She has friends at school that are from India, from Asia, mixed kids, blacks, whites. And so it's really been interesting. I would have come in here thinking, oh man, with all the racial history and segregation here, that this would be like the hardest city to navigate. I've really found that if you get to know people, for the most part, people aren't blatantly in your face racist. I think one of our biggest challenges is just people that have biases and stereotypes. a lot of times that they never really get challenged or those that go unchecked. So she's incurred situations, obviously. Especially working in academia where, you know, people are surprised that she's so eloquent and it's some microaggression kind of things. Mm-hmm. But I'd say for the most part, we haven't experienced that kind of blatant in your face racism. And I would say that's probably the majority report of our nation, too. I think a lot of this that we see, unfortunately, is an anomaly. But there is bias. There is stereotypes. Right. There's all these things that we still need to overcome as a people. But for us, we just haven't had those kind of challenges.
You know, we've had the exact same experience. We didn't know what it would be like. And even down to, you know, going to a restaurant and are they staring, are they not staring? In the very beginning, we noticed it. But now it's like we don't even see his skin color. Like it does not even cross my mind that he's different. Like he's just my son, you know. Yeah. So, and I think that's what's beautiful about it. But, yeah, we've gotten nothing but encouragement and support.
I think it's funny, man. I'm 6'7". My wife's 5'2". So I'm like, if they're staring, they're probably like, wow.
Yeah, look at that. That's great. All right, so let's talk about Bean. I mean, really, from the beginning, that's what we've been talking about, yeah, is your relationship with Christ. What do you do to personally guard that time? You mentioned that's an early wake-up time, 3:45. But if you're going to get up and put in that kind of time physically, you have said, I am going to spend first fruits of my morning with the Lord.
Amen.
How does that impact you as a leader, you at home? How does that connection with Christ really undergird everything that you're doing?
Yeah, it's paramount. And I love that this segment is called Being, because I think the most important part about our walk with Christ is not what we're doing, but who we're becoming. Mm. And we miss that. So we list these things. I need to be doing this, doing this, doing this. No, the whole point is to be becoming more and more like Christ, conform to the image of Christ. And so for me, that private time, I know when I'm up at 4, like, nobody's up, man. It's quiet. It's just me and the Lord. I've done everything from reading 5 Psalms and a proverb for the entire year as a devotion, to reading various devotional books, to reading through the Bible, to using the Book of Common Prayer. Like, in the last 15 years, like, any devotional out there, I've probably incorporated into my life at some point. But one of the things that I think has been instrumental in my life, and I would encourage anybody out there to do this, especially men, is get some men in your life, especially some older men.
Absolutely.
With some gray hair, who you can be you. And you don't have to have pretense. You don't have to wrap it up nice and neat. I mean, I have mentors in my life, some of them in their 70s, that I can share with them something, and I feel like I've identified the sin and the problem, and they're like, that's a symptom, bro. Here's what you're really dealing with. I absolutely need that. I feel like that's kept me becoming more of who God wants me to be, as much as reading through the scriptures. I think fellowship, being with men, being transparent, open, is such a vital part. I think that's why the enemy wants to isolate us more and more. That's why technology is advancing more and more. And if it keeps you from having those intimate relationships where you can really be open, man, it's hard to grow. You can't grow in a vacuum.
You can't.
You grow in relationships.
I'm so glad you brought that up. That is a repetitive theme. In fact, at the beginning of the show, in the recorded portion, I say, find your tribe.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about Iron Tribe. I'm talking about who are those people in your life who know you.
Yes.
That you can be real in front of. And in fact, this morning on Instagram, right before you walked through my doors, I posted a picture of me and my small group.
Yeah.
And I was like, I need these men, because I want to drift and live in isolation, and I need community.
That's right. I need guys
who can call me out on my stuff, who I can be real with. And I find, especially in the entrepreneur circles, especially in, I'm at the top of my game, I'm leading this thing, I'm growing this thing, that men are isolated.
Yeah.
They have teams, they have staff, they have families, but there's no one they can be real with. And so I think that is absolutely huge, what you just articulated. So I do want to know, What does that look like? Is that a Bible study? Is that an accountability group? Yeah. Is that someone I just know I can call this guy with anything, or it's regular I'm meeting with these group of men?
So it's all the above.
Okay.
Some of the guys don't even live in Alabama, so that's a phone call.
Okay.
But that's a phone call that I can make and spend 2 hours just kind of dumping and receiving input and feedback. But that's also a close group of brothers and a consistent accountability where we meet on a regular basis. It's not Bible study, but at the same time, it's getting together and it's asking those hard questions and just opening up to one another. So that's what that looks like.
Great. For anyone who's interested in Aspire, maybe they've heard of it or this is the first time they've heard about it. If they're in Birmingham,
yeah,
how could they get involved?
Yeah, so reach out to us. It's real easy to find, aspiremovement.org. You can also give us a phone call, 205-235-2355. Just leave us a message with your information. We'll get back to you. But we're obviously on all the social handles as well, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. But we would love to hear from you. I think oftentimes the reason that people don't get involved as a mentor is usually boils down to fear and time. One of the reasons we love what we do and we feel like it works is because it doesn't take you out. If you're working 60 hours a week and then you got your family and you got, you know, all these activities you're involved in, the last thing you want to do is leave them and go do ministry. So what our ministry allows is you're just incorporating this kid into the fabric of the things that you're already doing. And so as far as time, yeah, is it a time commitment to go pick them up and drop them off? Sometimes, but you're going to benefit. Your family is certainly going to benefit, and that kid is going to benefit as well. And then when it comes to overcoming fear, you know, I've always learned, just take the next step. Just take the next step.
Well said. Well, where do you see Aspire going in the future? What are your big dreams?
Yeah, so I would love to see every single kid in Birmingham have a mentor. And what's interesting is we have 1,600 churches in Metro Birmingham. If each church just had 20 mentors, we would literally have every kid matched up with a mentor.
Okay, when you say every kid, you don't mean
Birmingham City proper.
But I mean every kid who's a single parent.
Yes,
kid.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes,
okay.
Correct.
That was the 38,000
yes.
number you gave? Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
So all 38,000 reached with mentors.
Yeah.
Man, you think that'd change our city?
I think it would absolutely change
the city. Oh my goodness, the ripple effects of that.
Yeah. The reality of it is we have no idea the lasting impact that one of those relationships is going to have on the city. Mm. But if you get a whole movement of people, you know it's going to make a huge impact.
What about listeners who aren't in Birmingham who think, man, this is kind of stirring something in my heart? What would you encourage them to do? Because this is not a problem isolated to Birmingham, Alabama.
Absolutely.
Right. Any encouragement there for someone who can't plug into Aspire?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot of different agencies. There's usually some kind of mentoring agency in every major metropolitan area. Reach out to us and we'll let you know. We have partners in various cities. We'll let you know kind of, you know, who looks like us, so to speak, and does similar things that we do. But we would love to just point you in that direction to support you, to encourage you in any way that we can. And hey, we might help you build the Aspire movement in your particular city.
Man, scale this thing.
We're getting to the point where we have something that is we can replicate. Obviously, that comes by way of just becoming excellent in who we are here in Birmingham. But we're really getting close to that point where we can scale.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
The entrepreneur in me loves that part. Well, Jason, man, it's been an awesome conversation. You are inspiring. What you're doing is inspiring. I know to a firsthand account just of success stories and just the difference you guys are already making. Love what you had to share. I may never ride 15,000 miles in a year, but I'm gonna get up every morning and pump iron and thinking about you while you're out there hitting the road. I did want to ask, when you're doing these long rides, I'm assuming you're incorporating prayer into that too. I mean, that's a lot of time on that bike.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There are times that I'll listen to a sermon on podcast via podcast. There are times where I, you know, listen to music. There are times when I absolutely listen to nothing, where it literally is. And there's times that I'll stop on the bike and I'll literally just begin to give God thanksgiving. I've been real intentional that my prayer on the bike is more centered around being thankful and gratitude. Although there are some times when I'm screaming down Columbiana Road at 55, 60 miles an hour where I'm praying for mercy. Please, tired Uncle Flat.
Yes, not now.
That's right.
Well, man, just a pleasure to have you on. I'm really inspired by your story. Thanks.
Forrest, thank you so much for having me, man. I really appreciate it.
All right, Jason.